A jury in Kansas has found three men guilty on all counts in a conspiracy to bomb a housing complex of Somali refugees. At the heart of that trial, in the defendant's own words, was a fear and hatred of Muslims. But Islamophobia in America goes back centuries before September 11th, 2001. That's according to Khalid Beydoun, associate professor of law at the University of Detroit Mercy School of Law and author of the new book, American Islamophobia: Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear.
These foundational stereotypes that drive how we envision and imagine Muslim identity today are, they're centuries old. They've been adopted by American courts. They've been spewed by the framers of the Constitution. So the substance, the content that really drives Islamophobia today has been, you know, woven deeply into the American, you know, legal and political fabric.
You say that laws like the Patriot Act or certain forms of policing aren't just sort of beefing up of the state police function, but are at their core Islamophobic. Why do you say that?
I define laws like the Patriot Act, like NSEERS, the National Security Entry and Exit Registration System, which was the Muslim registry before Trump proposed the Muslim registry enacted after 9/11, as structural Islamophobia. It's really important to understand Islamophobia as something that is coming from the state and something that is in fact spearheaded by the state. So these laws that are, you know, enforced after 9/11, you know, manifest the state-sponsored, the structural Islamophobia, because it's the state embracing this basic tenet. And if you were to kind of reduce the definition of Islamophobia to one basic tenet, it would be that any expression, any manifestation of Muslim identity is tied to the presumption of terrorism. And we see how these laws are built upon that basic definition. So it's key to see the state as the lead actor that carries forward this, you know, Islamophobic narrative by policy and by police programming that starts with the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 terror attacks, but is continued on with the Obama administration and obviously is intensified now with the third phase of the war on terror with Trump.
Domestically, what would effective anti-terror policing look like to you, ideally, without the sort of metastatic Islamophobia that you're talking about in the law?
The first pivotal step is to sort of disentangle the idea that only Muslims in Islam can give rise to terrorism, right? There's this conflation, obviously, embraced by counterterror agencies and apparatuses, that Islam is conflated with terrorism and that terrorism is exclusively an enterprise that's committed by Muslims. The second step is to frame counterterror approaches that are driven more by statistics rather than stereotype. And if you look at stats coming from the government itself, they clearly show that the vast majority of mass shootings or acts that aren't defined as terrorism or sort of investigated or enforced as terrorism are committed by white males, right? White mass shooters, the sort of characters we see committing mass atrocity in places like Parkland, Las Vegas, Dylann Roof in South Carolina. So we sort of have to strip our understanding of terrorism from this racial and religious caricature that is Muslim and that is Arab and Middle Eastern.
What about the cases where radical interpretations of Islam are at the root of an attack or a planned attack? How should American authorities go about preventing those types of crimes without resorting to Islamophobic policies?
We can't deny the fact that there are fringe sort of elements of the broader Muslim global population that engage in what I consider to be deviant interpretation of the Quran, the accompanying texts. Wahhabism comes to mind, which emanates from Saudi Arabia, which is the specific ideology that drives ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, Shabab. However, it's a very small scintilla of the spiritual ideology adopted by Muslims globally, and specifically Muslim Americans here domestically.
We're talking with Khalid Beydoun, author of American Islamophobia. Khalid, let me play you this clip that a lot of people will remember from the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia in July 2016.
Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
Kizer and Ghazala Khan lost their son, Army Captain Humayun Khan, in 2004 during the Iraq War. Khan's speech was a huge hit at the DNC, but Khalid Beydoun, you were critical. But Hala Badoun, you're critical of how Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Democrats used the Khan family in this case.
We see, candidate Clinton using the Khans to kind of further this idea that, Muslims have to exist within this really rigid binary. You're either a good Muslim, like a Khizr Khan who, waves the Constitution, is always really keen on apologizing or condemning a terror act, even though Muslims had nothing to do with a terror act, sort of overcompensates or overperforms his patriotism or citizenship and belonging in the United States, and engages in this really, I think, dangerous performance where, Muslims have to perpetually prove that they're good citizens, perpetually prove that they're good patriots, perpetually prove that they're not attached or connected to, concerning elements or terrorist elements. And if you don't do that, if you don't engage in this performance, then the presumption is that you qualify as a bad Muslim. So obviously that leaves no room for individuals like myself who are, critical thinkers who might be critical of American domestic policy or foreign policy. Because by virtue of doing that, you're compromising your, conspicuous display of patriotism. And then the presumption is you're a bad Muslim. And being a bad Muslim is not just this label. It opens the door to the possibility of being surveilled by the state. And it opens the door to being, victim to the kind of backlash we see coming from hate mongers and bigots on the ground.
Well, in the broad strokes of politics, though, which I think we both know are not always incredibly nuanced, you paint sort of in primary colors, don't you, a lot of times. A lot of people took the message of the Khans differently than you took it. They took it to say, no, not all Muslims are invaders or encroachers or illegal immigrants or they don't hate America. Here's a couple who gave their son. Here's a hero who died on the battlefield for American values. Sort of full stop. American Muslims can be American heroes just like everybody else, but you didn't see it that way.
So the presumption is a problematic one, right? So the idea, the starting point is that Muslims are foreigners, interlopers, encroachers. Whenever you start from a point like that, I think you kind of walk down a path or a trail of engaging in tropes, stereotypes, and positive tropes or benign ones also open the door to really flat and narrow understandings of a people. So instead of starting from that starting point, why doesn't Hillary Clinton talk about how 15 or 30% of the enslaved Africans in the antebellum South practice Islam? Why doesn't she talk about how Muslim communities being vibrant and being prominent well throughout the 19th century and living in the United States and being prosperous? Why doesn't she talk about the idea that Islam and Muslims are the fastest growing and most diverse population here in the United States? But the problem is that the starting point is always a negative one. Even a apparently positive illustration or showcasing of individuals that starts from that idea that Muslims are foreign and pariahs, I think, opens the door to basic and base readings.
Khalid Badoun, where's this country going to be in 50 or 60 years, do you predict? Look, this country looks back on Japanese internment, an issue that you teach in constitutional classes, with pretty high amount of shame. Now, a lot of people view the Trump phenomenon and white nationalism as sort of the last gasp of a demographically changing country. The country's getting more diverse. The country's getting browner. There's no stopping those demographics. So where do you think this country is going to be when it comes to Islamophobia, let's say 50 or 60 years on?
I have an optimistic sort of forecast for this country, to be honest with you. I think in 50 to 60 years, with the country becoming, obviously, more racially and ethnically and religiously diverse, that hopefully, I think, enables, a greater tolerance to trickle down to the broader population. Second, I think that, what I see happening, and there's clearly critiques to be had of what's happening, especially with young people becoming more tolerant and accepting. But I think in some, it's broadly a positive development where we see greater sort of, interracial communication and fluency. We see a greater understanding in a more honest grappling with this country's history by young people. And these are the future, leaders, the future policymakers, and so on. But I think we're going to look back on this war on terror moment, starting with the Bush administration, obviously extending to the most intense phase of Islamophobia with Trump, with the same sort of shame that we look back at, like you said, Korematsu, with the internment of Japanese Americans, with the same type of shame we look back at with legislation like the Chinese Exclusion Acts or the mandate that whiteness be a prerequisite for citizenship until 1952. I do honestly believe that in, 50 to 60 years, that, what this country is grappling with today with the war on terror is going to be one of these bleak, and tainted chapters of American history. Because the principles, I think, when I teach the Constitution, I'm a constitutional law professor, the principles that drive and that are embedded in, especially the Bill of Rights, I think are honorable, are commendable. And if we can kind of steer our country and steer our future in the direction of the principle versus the racism, the patriarchy, the Islamophobia, and the xenophobia that prevails today, then I think we can move in the right direction.
Khalid Beydoun is author of American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and the Rise of Fear. Professor, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.